Welcome to the Phoenix Cast, a podcast about cybersecurity, technology, and innovation issues in the military. We are your hosts, John,
Rich,
and Kyle.
Rich and I are both U.S. Marines, and the opinions expressed on the cast are those of the host, not official military policy. The opinions expressed by Kyle are his own, not of his employer or any other business he's associated with. For today's episode, no special guest, just the love between the hosts. So let's get into it. So we're going to be talking about the transition to first civ div, or for the non-military out there, transitioning to the civilian world. So I am the only one on the cast today who hasn't transitioned. So I'm going to just do a little back and forth between Rich and Kyle, and we're going to talk through both of their experiences of transitioning out of the military and give everybody an idea of what you should be thinking about as you're making your transition. So starting things right off the bat, and I'll go with Kyle since he made the full transition and didn't come back. Kyle, what were the factors that led to you leaving? And were they kind of personal? Were they military systemic? Or was there a third direction that we didn't catch here?
Yeah, no worries. Thanks for the kick over here, John. And I'm going to start by saying a couple things here. So we're going to talk for an hour about this subject. I am extremely passionate about this subject because my transition out, and we're going to get into this here in a bit. If I would have listened to most people who gave me advice in the military, I would have been really, really worse off. And I listened to people who were in the outside world already and who had made the transition previously. And things went a lot better for me because I went with my gut on that stuff. And so I just want everyone to keep in mind here, a lot of the opinions that I'm going to be sharing with you all may be somewhat controversial, maybe from a place that might deviate from traditional advice. And just like take that with a grain of salt. But I've been quite successful leaving the military. And I left the military in a very strange way. And John can attest to this. A lot of the people that we've had on this cast can attest to this. I was a Marine for just under 12 years. I was a chief warrant officer. And I rescinded my commission. I told them, no, thank you. Have a great day. And put in my resignation and left before 12 years. And everyone thought I was absolutely crazy. They said, you're 8 years away from retirement. Why would you do this? And I'll give you two major reasons why I left the entire armed forces. And the first was that I'd done a number of deployments. I'd spent many, many years away from my family, which is never a fun thing. And being in IT, there was a very clear understanding that the skills that I had and the quality of the work that I did, I could get out and make a pretty substantial sum of money in the outside world, which was always a positive thing. But at the time, like I was going through some personal issues, came back from a year in Afghanistan, and I was going through troubles. My marriage was going through troubles, and I made the decision mostly for personal reasons to get out. Basically, I wanted to be home with my kids every night. I wanted to be able to actually like control my destiny a little bit more than I had. And I basically said no thanks to retirement at that point, which was a huge decision, and it made a ton of waves. And I'm also going to throw this out here. And again, controversial opinions are going to abound here. I also left because I felt that the Chief Warrant Officer Corps in the United States Marine Corps was not a meritocracy in any possible way. If you had the time and grade and the time and service, you got the senior billet, even if you really sucked at your job. And I know how the officer corps works. I know how all the promotion process works, lineal numbers. I'm super familiar with it. I went through every possible thing I could. But the reality is you're on a very limited treadmill with very limited ability to have impact. And that's just the way it is. So I didn't want to spend the next 8 years of my life following people that I knew perhaps weren't the greatest at what they did. And I'm just going to leave it there without getting into any details. And that's the story of why I chose to get out. And I haven't regretted it for a minute.
All right. A quick follow-up on that, though. I have been told as a leader my entire career that I need to be careful about letting my Marines get certifications, because if they get them, they'll get out. And given that you had a CCNP, just for the listening audience so that we can make sure we have it out there, if I hadn't have let you certify, would that have altered your decision at all?
I mean, absolutely not. And we're going to talk a little bit about, you know, certifications and training and stuff here in a bit. But I mean, whether or not I had the certifications or not, that was great training. And, you know, I learned a ton from John. John was my instructor for most of my CCMP training. And I got out with a 4-year degree in IT, CC CCNP, CCDP security certification, my CISSP. Like, I have, you know, the entire Pokemon collection of certifications that I would have needed to be successful in the outside world, and I have used every single one of them, and I don't regret them for a second. Did it make me more competitive to get out? Yes. Did it, like, make the difference of me getting out? Absolutely not. Now, I'll also say that I'd been in for almost 12 years at that point. Like, if I was just coming off my first enlistment and I had something that, I don't think that there is a great argument to say don't train your Marines and get them certifications, because the value is too great. If you are sitting here listening to this guest and you think if we let our Marines certify, they will get out, you, my friend, are focusing on the wrong problem. And that's all I'll say about that.
Thanks for addressing that. All right. same question over to Rich. And it's been a couple minutes. So, Rich, again, what were the factors that led to you transitioning out of the military? And were they generally personal circumstances, systemic military type stuff, or something else?
Yeah. Well, thanks for kicking it over to me, guys. I guess I'll say, for me, to just be blunt up front, it was a blend of both. There were some personal decisions in there, and then there were ones related to the service. Whether they're chronic or systemic in nature, I'll talk to that in a minute. But I honestly believe that, you know, there are seasons of your life, just like there are seasons in nature, right? And so, without getting too philosophical or religious in nature here, the time that I transitioned, so I left a little earlier than Kyle. So Kyle, about the 12-year mark. For me, it was around the nine and a half year mark when I left. So I didn't get peppered with the, hey, you crossed 10 years, you have to stay to 20, right? People were like, oh, you know, you're 9 and a half, so don't worry, because it's an exact science that if you hit 10, then you should stay to 20. But if you don't hit 10, then you shouldn't, which I kind of laughed very hard to. But anyhow, having said that, back to the seasons of your life type phrase, it was just the right time personally, and then I think professionally, for me to try something new. So what I mean by that is, at the time, I was an instructor working with John in an instructing capacity, teaching young officers how to do technology leadership in the Marine Corps, and had spent a whole bunch of hours helping build a curriculum and try to get that curriculum American Council for Education certified so that we could help Marines whenever they decided to transition and they would get college credit for the training that they were taking and education they were taking in the Marine Corps. But for me, for about a year solid, I went pretty hard kind of doing the Geo Bachelor thing away from my fiance. And then we decided to get married. And then after we got married, about a year later, we decided to have children. And much like Kyle, I really wanted to be there for the birth of my children. And I knew that if I stayed on active duty, my next tour would be, you know, out of the supporting establishment where I was teaching and into the operating forces, and I would deploy. So anyhow, I had a long talk with my wife. I actually did want to deploy. I'd been working very hard with my HR representative, which we call monitor in the Marine Corps, to get to the West Coast, because I had never served out of 1st Marine Expeditionary Force. So anyhow, long story short, there was a family issue and component to it, to get out and, you know, make sure I was there for the birth of my children. But then also, and here's where the professional side comes in, going through a couple deployments before I became an instructor, and John and I have talked about this a lot, you know, we learned on the job what performance-based skills were required rather than just the knowledge-based skills that we tended to get out of our technology training when we went through as young company grade officers, as second lieutenants. So for me, I was like, hey, how could I help the organization from a personal perspective? And I decided with my wife, hey, I'm going to get out and go into the private sector and try to get a technology job. And I was one of those folks that didn't have the certifications, right? It was all hands-on work, you know, going through the industry accepted certs like, Cisco Certified Network Associate and all those kind of network engineering related things that were related to my occupational field. I'll get into this more during the talk, but basically it boiled down to two things for me. There was a personal family component of it, and then there was this professional component that I knew there have to be folks in the service that get out or do fellowships or internships when they're company grade officers, which are usually reserved for like later when you're a field grade officer or you're a lieutenant colonel or a colonel, to go do these industry partnerships where you learn what the private sector does and try to innovate on the public sector side after you gain those performance-based skills. So I guess the last thing I'll say here before, you know, open the conversation up broader is also at the time, this was around 2012 when the military was going through a large drawdown, right? President Obama had announced a drawdown. There were a lot of highly talented enlisted and officer personnel that were leaving the service components, one, because they either felt that they did their service and deployed multiple times and, you know, were ready to become like strong private sector citizens again. And two, all these private sector companies were establishing programs to pull in that talent to maximize in the leadership and, I guess, decisive type nature of the folks that were getting out, meaning they could operate in crisis type environments. And that's really hard to teach unless you actually have the experience. So the timing was right. And then there were, as I mentioned, two components, a personal and a professional component. So I don't know if that answers your question directly, John, or if I kind of muddied the waters there, but those were kind of my motivations. So back out to the group.
And Rich, I want to double click on a couple of things you said there. And, you know, we all have a lot of friends that have gotten out, and you mentioned that a lot of you saw a lot of your peers getting out here. And I hate to maybe stereotype this in some way, but we tended to work with people in our cadre, if you will, that were very good at their jobs. And if you're very good at your job and you are a U.S. Marine, it becomes almost more and more difficult for you to, what's the right way to put this? It becomes more difficult for you to continue putting up with the things that you see impeding what you already know is correct and what you already know is the right things to do over and over again. And I think that on a very short timeline of establishing credibility and excellence, that it will become more and more attractive to find alternatives to staying in each and every day. If you have ambition and drive and you have a desire to see things get better, it becomes more difficult to stay in.
Yeah. So Kyle, I'll jump in there too. So I think you're right. Right. So I think that the military being an all volunteer service, and this is me going to be very Boy Scouty about, you know, the armed forces of the United States in general, you're not going to run into all the time environments where you're just like allowed to flourish because of your natural thirst for knowledge, your skill set that you bring, right? The experience that you carry from other, job occupations in the military or, you know, whatever walk of life you come from. But I agree, right? That like there are certain times and places, and John and I got to be honest with you, in the past year, we went through one of these moments where we had such an amazing leader that just literally believed that the young bucks that had the passion coupled with the skill and experience that they would just sling missions our way and then get out of the way, right? You don't experience that in the armed forces very often, right? I would be hard pressed to say you probably in a 20-year career maybe go through four of those seasons, right? Where maybe four times you meet this like leader that's just like, hey, you know what? You guys know what you're doing. I have this wickedly hard problem to solve. I'm not going to solve it myself. So why don't you guys propose some solutions and rock and roll? I don't know if you agree with that, you know, Kyle, or not, but that's been my experience.
I agree completely on that. Like, I had a captain, Fabio Yunki, one of the best get out of the way people I've ever served with when I was over in Afghanistan, who let me and my entire spee cell completely off the chain. He had, you know, there's a concept called speed of trust. You should read that book. It's pretty awesome. And he had complete speed of trust in us to get the job done effectively and to let him know when he needed to get involved to help. And that was the most successful tour I ever had, full stop, because of that. And I think that I had two seasons of that. One was very short and one was my time in Afghanistan. And it was great, like absolutely great.
Yeah. What's interesting, you know, about that topic too, is like, as you get older, right, or you mature, you start to realize you get farther away from the performance hands-on things, right? At least in my occupation. So, you know, for those who don't know that are listening, you know, Kyle was what we call a restricted officer, right? So he was retained for his, you know, MOS proficiency, his occupational proficiency, what we would call technical proficiency, right? So Kyle got to stay hands-on for most of his career. those of us that are in what are called unrestricted roles or unrestricted officer roles are kind of retained for, you know, leadership and things of that nature. And however, so as you get older, you know, you're supposed to kind of back away from the hands-on and provide the more strategic vision to the organization. And that's not an easy transition, right? Especially because I think there's two groups of folks. There's groups of folks who are both restricted and unrestricted that just know that being proficient is a thing you must maintain no matter what rank you're at. And you just put in the extra time, right? You're punching your ticket, you're doing podcasts, you're reading things, you're taking classes. It's the whole continuous lifelong learning thing that we constantly talk about in the military service, right? But we don't actually practice on a daily basis, if I could just be very blunt about it. So, and you know, we talked about MCDP-7 earlier, right? Multiple podcasts ago about training and education and how you have to just embody that no matter what rank you're at. So, but I guess my point in saying all this is that as I get older and I move farther from hands-on and more into the strategic roles, one, that's not easy. So I'm not trying to give a cop-out to folks that are like a high rank in the military that might be listening, but it's not an easy transition, especially if you like hands-on stuff. But you do have to get away from that and just provide opportunities for, you know, folks that do hands-on work to solve wickedly hard problems that you're not going to do by yourself. Right. So there's an element of humility and empowerment that I think come as you mature throughout your career. And I guess I'll end my rant there because it's not really about transition. It's more about how do we become a better leader as I grow through and stay in the military. But yeah, those are two attributes I thought I'd throw out there.
Yeah, awesome. Makes sense. And Kyle and Rich, thanks for also sharing, because I think this is something we miss a lot of times, is thanks for sharing the personal component of this too, because, you know, marriages and finances and personal situations do make a difference. And if we don't talk about that, and if we don't allow a space for that, then, you know, we're not really being realistic about what the real factors are. And sometimes we oversimplify situations. Right. So moving on from there, what I have been told, and this will be great for the two of you to kind of bounce off of, what I've been told is I get ready to transition, there's a couple, like maybe three main things I should keep my eye on. First, the military provides transition assistance. So we have for the civilians out there, we have essentially like training that we need to attend that prepares us to transition to the civilian world. So that is one resource that we have. I have been told by multiple people that as you transition, you need to have yourself a transition mentor. And then there's this third thing that no one really talks about, but is definitely out there, especially if you have a LinkedIn account or anything like that. And that's the kind of like recruiters and headhunters. So those are the three things that kind of are in my sphere. And keep in mind, I'm half a decade away from being able to transition, or at least theoretically doing that. Right. So
you're going to be a general someday, John, I'm telling you.
Yeah. Things that are not happening for 5,000, Kyle. Anyways,
let's stick to that, yeah, man. Let's hit those in order.
Is that right? Are those actually the three things, or have I been sold a bill and it's way off?
So let's hit those three things, and then I think I would add maybe one or two others to that. And Rich, I don't know, does that sound okay to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, coming off mic there. But yeah, it sounds great. Let's go.
Okay, so let's talk about, is it still called TAPS and TAMS or TAMS and TAPS or just the transition program getting out of the Marines, right, John?
They've changed it so many times, I don't even know what they call it anymore.
So you, as a Marine, if you decide to get out, whenever you get out, whether you've been in for 2 years or 20 years, you will have to go to this, and it is your transition checkbox on your checkout sheet that you will give to the S1. And I'm going to tell you my very blunt feelings on this. If you have gotten to the point where you are expecting the transition program class to teach you what you need to do to get out of the military, you are ridiculously behind the curve. Like, you have put off something that should have been addressed months in advance until this point. So what you should do is sit there and listen, because at that point, you will definitely need it. I think I would challenge every single Marine that is in comm or IT in any way, shape, or form to go to that class and have all the answers to the questions that they will pose to you already received, right? How to build a resume should not be something that you're learning in that class. How to go to job fairs and do job searches, which, you know, again, nothing you should be thinking about. And if I have to summarize it in any way, shape, or form, it is that transition program will not help you if you are in the IT community. It will not give you good advice that will help you land a job. And it will not prepare you for what you're about to enter in the outside world of interviewing at tech companies. So all of that to say, it is required. So you're going to do it because they're not going to let you out until you do. But you should think about many things before you show up there. Rich, thoughts?
Yeah. So I'll just say I double click on that and just say, you know, agree in all caps, right? As loud as I possibly can. I guess, to put it in somebody else's words that said it more succinctly than I ever could. There's many points in your career, I think, that people reference different quotes and stuff of that nature. But like the poem Invictus by William Ernest Henley, the last line of that poem is, "I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul," right? Like, there is no better way to state you own your life, period, to include the transitions you lead at different phases of it, or what I was calling seasons earlier in the cast, right? So when you decide that you're going to transition from public sector, military, armed forces service, you need to own it top to tail, right? I'm not going to belabor this anymore. I just double click on what you said, Kyle. Like, you just have to own it. I guess I'll leave it at that.
Yep. And just first off, thanks for bringing poetry into this. We needed that. We need more of that in this podcast.
More poetry. Was one of the feedbacks we got from Twitter.
Awesome. I'm glad we're addressing this. If you're relying on this TAPS and TAMS program or whatever the transition program is, if that's what you're relying on, there is going to be a huge collection of people who are better prepared than you.
Sorry to interrupt. But yeah. And the other thing is, like, you know, the transition program is a tool, right, that you can put in your toolkit, right? But it is not, like, to phrase it a little bit differently here, right? There is no master algorithm that applies to everybody leaving the Marine Corps or the armed forces in general, right? So make your own algorithm, use your own tools, right, and own it. Go back to you, Kyle. Sorry for interrupting.
No, that's 100%. All right, so I think we have a consensus between at least Rich and I on the transition program. John, you want to talk about, let's move over a little bit to having like a get-out mentor. I really like this concept. And I like this concept selfishly because I'm very active in a few like IT and comm specific Facebook groups, and I provide a lot of mentorship to Marines who are getting out about career advice. I've offered this up on LinkedIn as well. If you're a Marine and you're getting out and you want some advice, please feel free to look me up. It's not like anything I charge for or anything. This is just me trying to help people understand the world they're getting into. And if you want to get into cloud technology in particular, please look me up. I will give you very relevant advice. But I had two people that I went to when I was getting out who had previously gotten out. They were both officers who had gotten out, and I used them for a great deal of mentorship, and they provided me guidance that was absolutely invaluable. They gave me perspectives on the hiring process and the interview process and what it's like to work for different sized companies and things that I just simply never would have gotten. All the reading in the world and, you know, Twitter and Facebook and all these things that I was using to kind of research companies would never have given me that level of personal advice. And also, and we'll get to this later, they helped me demilitarize myself. And I mean that in the like acronym soup and job titles that don't mean anything in the outside world. And, you know, like people are like, I was a communications chief or whatever. And it's like, nobody knows what that means, bro. Like, you have to figure out how to translate so much of what you did in the military into something that anyone in the civilian sector will have any understanding about. And they helped me do that extensively. So I say, don't just have one, have a few that you can bounce ideas off of.
Yeah. And also, I mean, you can attest to, I think, and it'll be a question later, but I have called Kyle annually for about the last decade and said, like, hey, I'm 15 years from getting out, 10 years from getting out. Every year is like, hey, we talked last year about doing X, Y, and Z. Am I still on the path? Am I going to be ready? And we're talking 10 years out, I've been doing this by working with Kyle and others. So I would recommend keep doing that and keep asking yourself, are you relevant? Are you doing what you need to be doing?
Absolutely. And I think that having a plan that you almost overhaul every 2 years. So if you've just joined the military yesterday, you're a private, whatever the new MOS is for data communications, but like you're a private data guy, you should be have your four-year plan understood. And if that four-year plan changes to you reenlisting, or if that is your four-year plan, you need to understand how to prep for that and always have a plan B. Like, I can't stress this enough. You have no idea what tomorrow will bring in your life, you know, from you know, tragedy and disaster to amazing opportunities. And you just have to be prepared for all of those things.
Yeah. So I'll jump in here, guys, because I think I totally agree with this concept of like not making the same mistakes that others have made, and seeking out people to connect with, right? And, you know, we'll use the phrase having a mentor, but just, you know, having somebody to connect with when you're going through this process, even if they're not, if you're not seeking mentorship, but somebody that you can just talk to, right? So you know, I talked earlier about like the transition programs being a tool in the toolkit, right? And yeah, I guess I'll just throw this out there. Like, I had, you know, family members that, you know, are Korean War vets or Vietnam War vets, and these things did not exist, right, in the state that they do now when they were going through their transition. So I don't want to sound like I'm poo-pooing these programs too much. It's just that my key point, I think I said it, not actually, here's the knife hand moment, guys, break, knife hand. The ownership
classic
piece is what I was trying to drive there, right? But my point is, there are programs and there are tools. So here's where I give my quick shout out, kind of like, you know, Kyle was talking about and how John was kind of referencing Kyle. So one tool in the toolkit that I found very useful was the Marine for Life Network, right? Or MFL for short. So when I was transitioning, you know, I left the East Coast and was going to the West Coast. And I'll talk about strategies when we get to talking about strategies during the podcast. But I used the Marine for Life program only because I got reached out to by one person that worked at Amazon. She's phenomenal, former captain or for 0402, is immensely influential in the company right now as the stock continues to skyrocket. But she built the program that is that was the military partnership that Amazon runs right now. So folks that are trying to get into that organization, right? So she was phenomenal. I'll leave names off here because I haven't got their permission to use them today. But like, if you're listening, you know who you are. But she was phenomenal. She was the one who brought me in to that organization. And then I had a couple other people that I talked to also met through the Marine for Life program. One was a Bainbridge Island firefighter, Lieutenant Colonel, retired pilot, phenomenal guy. Just talked to him every day about what it meant to transition, right? And then there were two other folks that both worked at Starbucks up in the Pacific Northwest. One was a master sergeant, the other one was a captain. Captain got out and ran his own Starbucks, shop itself, right, location or site. And then the master sergeant was like running their, much like, yeah, the female 402 at Amazon was running Starbucks' military talent partnership. And so, you know, I ended up landing at one of those organizations, but really I used those four individuals just to ask questions to, like, what was your strategy? And believe me, every one of them had a different thought process, right? But at the end of the day, they all ended up getting together at the same time and having a pint with me and just allowing me to ask questions, which was phenomenally helpful because you go through this. You know, I like to say that a lot of Marines are very type A personality, right? So they think, and I know I did when I was transitioning, or like, I should be able to get a great job. I'm a Marine, blah, 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 blah. And what they provided me was a level of realism that the private sector, you know, has that you're just not exposed to when you're in the public sector, specifically in the military, right? Like in the military, it's all about like, hey, how can I be at the top of my game? How can I be the most ready, right? And there is an analogy there in the private sector, but what's most important is, right, like what value do you bring to a team that that team does not have already, right? Like that's kind of what private sector employers are looking for. But anyhow, I'm kind of ranting too much here. I just wanted to say, like, there were four people that I connected through the Marine for Life Network as a tool, right? That allowed me to just have a little bit of mentorship, but most importantly, just have dialogue with as I transition, just to like reduce the stress level to an acceptable level. I don't know if that makes sense to you guys, because it's stressful, whether we like to admit that or not. It's wickedly stressful.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah. And I'll also add that, like, you know, having these mentors is it can reduce your stress because you'll get perspectives that you didn't have, but it's also going to be a deluge of information, which will increase your stress because all these things you hadn't considered previously will all of a sudden become, you know, in play. But it's always better to know more than know less. So I'm taking all of it, every bit of advice I can from everybody who wants to give it.
Yeah, that makes sense. So transitioning from that, so it sounds like both of you very much supportive of mentors. So,
yes.
And this is maybe the most ignorant comment or off the wall comment that I'm going to put on the podcast. But I can tell you when it comes to buying some goods, whether it be clothing or gym equipment or IT things, I think there's probably a tenfold increase in my confidence if someone I personally know tells me, this is the thing I need to do. And so I guess my question to you is, recruiters are like, if you want it to be, that could be like half of your connections on LinkedIn. And my question is the recruiter route, recruiter headhunter versus your friends, your coworkers, your acquaintances network. What is the thing that really gets you to the promised land, to the job you need, to the place you need to go? Or is it really a combination of the two? Because I got to be honest, knowing nothing about this, the recruiter thing kind of has me skeptical, but man, does it seem to be a cottage industry.
Rich, do you want to take this one first? I've let off the last two, man, and I've got strong opinions. I don't want to taint the waters.
Yeah, I'll take this one first. So John, I'm going to answer your question directly first, and then based on my experience, and then I'm just going to talk through a couple of quick strategies and then turn over to Kyle. So to answer your question directly, I didn't use headhunters. I didn't, right? Looking back, should I have done that? I think that would have been a better way for me to cast my net far and wide, right? So if you want somebody to help manage your transition and find opportunities because for whatever reason, you're having a hard time figuring out what it is you want to do, which is totally normal, by the way. But I'll get into that in a minute. Then I think it's very relevant for you to seek out an organization that will provide you options, right? And then help you put a portfolio or a strategy together, right, to move forward. For me, when I was transitioning personally, I wanted to own that process for myself. So I started thinking about that years out, to Kyle's point, right? Like, always have a plan, right? Like what General Mattis would say, like, have a plan to kill everybody you meet, right? Always have a plan. So
don't say that in your interview, just for the record.
Yeah, by the way. Yeah. Depending on what you want your job.
There you go.
Yeah. Well, I'm still laughing at that. But my point here is, I didn't use headhunters. However, I had friends that did use them, and they were highly effective because they knew what role they wanted a headhunter to play. I have had friends that use headhunters, and it didn't go well for them because they didn't really understand the role the headhunter was playing in their strategy, right?
Yeah.
So pause for a second. I want to jump into talking about strategies. But before I do that, Kyle, did you want to jump in here, or you want me to rant a little more about strategies?
If you're okay with literally teeing me up for what I wanted to talk about anyway, I'm going to run with that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so here's the deal that I think very passionately about with regards to recruiters and headhunters, right? And so I'm gonna define these terms for the rest of our conversation here. This may be totally ineffective or the wrong term, and to anybody out there who's in HR recruiting, I apologize. A recruiter works for a specific company to find people to come work at that company. A headhunter plays the field and has like lots of companies that they will try to seed candidates to, and they will basically like collect resumes like cards in a deck. And then when a company comes to them and says, yo, I need a person who knows, I don't know, Cisco networking, they can go, okay, there we go. I got three people that know Cisco networking, 1, 2, 3. And that's literally how the process works. I've hired a number of people using headhunters. And once you find a good one, they're incredibly effective. But it's important to understand that like recruiters work for companies and they try to find people for those companies. And the important thing to understand is that they're just like people, right? They're going to make mistakes and have awesome systems that they work with. And it's a personal relationship, because that recruiter, they've got a job to do, right? They've got this list of positions that they need to fill, right? Like maybe they've got like a senior network engineer who's worked on Cisco and Juniper. And I'm just throwing something out there that's kind of ubiquitous, right? So let's just say they have that, right? Their job is to go out and find them. They're going to go on LinkedIn. They're going to go look at other networks. They're going to, you know, check out Indeed. They're going to respond to the, you know, 150 applications a day if you post something publicly on LinkedIn or whatever. And they're going to filter through all of that stuff, because of those 150, 100 are just like robo apply or robo applications, which don't even apply. I've had, you know, like electrical engineers apply for software engineering jobs with no purpose or reason to it. And they are just looking for their diamond in the rough. And so if you are working with a recruiter at a company, you have to understand the job you want there. And the recruiter has to be looking for someone to fill that job. It's a very like one-to-one relationship where you understand what you want and you understand what the recruiter wants. And the recruiter needs to understand what you want. It's got to work both ways. But let's just say you want to work for Amazon or Google, right? Two best companies to work for. You know, Rich has worked for one, I've worked for the other. And if you want that, you need to know the job you're going for. Your resume had better be tailored specifically to that job. And you need to make a good connection with the recruiter. Those are the three things you need to do. If it's a headhunter will let you be a little more indecisive, where you can kind of just give your resume to a headhunter and say, these are kind of the jobs I'm looking for. Let me know what you find. And, you know, if you don't really know what you want to do when you grow up, that can be very, very lucrative and very, very easy to help you at least get opportunities that you just are trying to figure out what you're going to do. None of these, though, should be none of these are mutually exclusive. So if you know that you want to be a network engineer and you want to go work for Cisco, right? Like, cool, go make connections with Cisco recruiters and also make connections with headhunters in your agency that are in your area that work in your particular field. And all of these things are going to lead you to the right line. But like, especially if you're good at what you do, those two resources, like, almost exclusively, every single job I've gotten since I got out of the military, I either got with a personal connection to a recruiter or the use of a headhunter. So, like, let that be a thing, because in this industry, y'all, it is all about who you know. All right, Rich, back to you.
Yeah, no, I mean, I feel like that was a moment from old school where, you know, Cal blacked out for a second and then, you know, he's back. I mean, seriously, that was phenomenal, right? Like, I couldn't have said that any better, which I was kind of ranting to before Kyle took over, right? And this is what I'm, you know, kind of meant by, got to understand the roles people play and then employ them accordingly. Just like, you know, if you're a leader in the military, you've got to understand the capabilities of your Marines or your people and then employ them in accordance with their capabilities, right? So know what headhunters do, as Kyle mentioned, know what recruiters do. And kind of like what I talked about earlier, you know, recruiters are looking specifically for that skill set that is absent in the organization that they were tasked to go find the skill set for. So if you happen to have that skill set, recruiters will be your best friend, right? Generally, both headhunters and recruiters will be your best friend. But having said that, I mean, this is just really well said, Kyle. And so I think what I could add on to that, just to kind of push the clutch and switch gears for a second, is not just what, you know, human or people resources are there from a recruiter or a headhunter perspective, but you should think about having a deliberate plan that you're trying to execute, and then also realize that your time in the military service has taught you that as soon as you cross the line of departure or you step off with the first step in a direction on that plan, right, it's going to change. And so try not to increase your own stress level when the plan changes, right? It's the same thing we do in the service, right? You get a mission, you plan it, you execute it, and you realize that as soon as you start to execute it, the plan goes to shit, right? To use
just quoted Tyson, everybody they plan till they get punched in the face.
Exactly,
so
right?
So true.
But you should have a strategy that you can stick to, right? And there's a couple things that, you know, I wish somebody had told me before I transitioned. So I'm just going to drop a couple of these nuggets and try not to rant too much. And John and Kyle, please interject where you see fit here. Yeah. But
go for it.
So I think, you know, outside of the ownership thing that I talked about, where you're in the driver's seat, right? And, you know, outside of it, coupled with this, like, seasons of your life kind of comment that I made earlier, Like, just like they teach in the Marine Corps that you want to put the enemy on the horns of a dilemma, meaning that they have to make a decision and commit to it. You need to be decisive about what you're doing and why you're doing it, and then decide and then go all in, right, on that decision and see where it leads you until you have to make, you know, a change to your plan. So what I mean by that is, you know, you're deliberately transitioning for a reason. Like, insert whatever that reason is, you're transitioning, right? So just like you were, for whatever reason, made the decision to join the armed forces and join the military service, and you had a passion for it, and everybody can remember what it feels like, especially if you were a Marine, right, what it feels like to earn that Eagle, Globe, and Anchor, you want to have that same amount of passion and apply it to whatever your deliberate plan is to transition from the public armed forces occupation to a private sector occupation or another public sector occupation as a civilian, right? So you have to have that passion, right? I cannot, you know, overstate the ownership and the passion piece. But once you realize that you have that passion, you're all in, you've made a decision that you want to transition, then you start to think through some strategies, right? So one of the ones you hear people say all the time is location versus vocation, right? Some people pick a part of the world they want to go to for whatever reason, and then they go there, right? They go all in, they transition, and they get there, and then they start looking for jobs in that region, right? And it doesn't have to be sequential like that, but they pick the location and prioritize that over the vocation or the job, right? Then there's others that are like, you know what? I want to climb the private sector ladder. I'm hungry. I have this passion for whatever job sector I want to go into. And so you pick a vocation and you're like, I want to do that, right? And then if you're lucky, and this is where I feel like Kyle and myself were fortunate, is we had, I believe, the passion for a vocation and the passion for a location. And those two things married up like the planets sometimes align every few decades, right? So yeah, I tell folks like, hey, if you want to play jazz or be a jazz, you know, professional in the early 1900s, you went to places like Harlem. Why? Because that's where all the other jazz players went, right? So like for me, when I was transitioning, I knew the vocation I wanted to go into, which was information security or something technology related. And I knew the location I wanted to go to, which was the Pacific Northwest. So it was super easy for me to align both of those together. And this is what I mean by strategy. I'm not talking about this like rocket science type level doctorate thesis plan, just a basic plan that makes sense to the layman, to common sense to you, so you can drive after your passions and get there. So there's this location versus vocation type strategy, which nobody kind of told me about. And it wasn't until I kind of connected with some of the folks through the Marine for Life program that this kind of came out. Right. And I think they now talk about this stuff in the transition program as one of the tools in the toolkit. But that to me, those are two big decisions. But the location versus vocation type strategy is a good way or a good lens to view things through. I think the other thing that I would recommend also is a strategy is, you know, what season of your life are you in? Are you in the work to live season? Or are you in the live to work season, right? So I was in the work to live season, right? I knew I was transitioning out and I wanted to spend time with my family. So I needed a job to support them. So I was in the work to live bucket or bin, right? A lot of young folks that transition out of the service are in the live to work bin, right? And they're like, hey, again, I want to climb the ladder. I want to get all these skills. I want to be a ninja, right, in cybersecurity or whatever your vocational field of choices. So, you know, work to live versus live to work, try to look at it from that lens as well. And then I think some advice, and you know, I'll kind of bring this up at the end and talk about this a little more deeper is, you know, you are transitioning. So realize that, like we preach on the Marine Corps side of the house in the military, that friction comes in transition, right? Whenever you're transitioning between phases of an operation or, you know, phases of planning, there's always friction involved in that, you know, or you're like, you know, replacing another unit in country and then they're leaving and you're taking that mission over, right? There's friction in that. So realize that there's going to be friction. You're going to have to need to deal with it. You're equipped to do it because you've done it in the military already. You just need to apply that to lower your stress level a little bit And what I mean by transitioning when it comes to occupations is your first job doesn't need to be your next career. It just needs to be your first job. So sometimes, you know, manage your own expectations internally. So I know that was a little bit of a rant there, but just to recap, right? Location versus vocation type strategy, a work to live versus live to work type lens or perspective. And then realize that the first job you get out of service is probably not going to be the last job you ever have for the rest of your life.
That's absolutely right. And I'll also add to that, right? Like when you join the military, you got a job, right? And you're going to be in that job for at least 4 years. And if you want a lat move, which is like kind of difficult to do, it's a big deal. And whether you get stationed in Miramar or stationed in Quantico or stationed in Cherry Point, you're going to be doing kind of the same job. Well, and newsflash, y'all, when you get out, you can do anything you want. And if you don't like what you're doing, you can quit and go do something else. So
whenever you want.
Whenever you want, like, you know, just they're going to stop paying you. So that's a thing you got to know. But just you don't need to decide what you want to be when you grow up the day you get out of the service or even before you get out of the service. You just need to prep for a bunch of opportunities. Like when I first got out of the service, I was going to be Mr. Network Guru. I went and led a network team for a network company. Like, oh, yeah. And then like I found out about cloud and said to myself, well, that's it. I'm not going to be a network person anymore. And you know, I kind of flushed 10 years of network experience down the toilet. I mean, that's a bad way to describe it because, I mean, I still use my network skills every single day. But I moved, right? I changed my education. I went and learned a new skill and I went and got a job doing that thing. And it didn't take long. It took like weeks to months, not years. And it was a very easy transition to do. So just don't think that you have to have it all figured out. Just know what you want to do next. Don't worry about what you want to do in 10 years or 15 years, really.
Okay, so that leads us into the next question, which is, what's the right time to do this? So when is the right time to start thinking about my transition? Is it 10 years out? Is it 5 years out? 2 years? 6 months? 1 month? Is it ever too early to be thinking about this? Or should I just kind of like mentally block everything out and 3 months beforehand start polishing a resume?
Not the latter. And I mean, I'll say this, right? John, you are what, at least 5 years away from getting out?
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm the default answer I'm going to say is how soon should I be thinking? You should be thinking 20 years in advance. You know, you need to have a plan if you're in the military right now for staying for a full 20, because that is a potential outcome that you could do that has tons and tons of benefits. But also, like, maybe not, right? Maybe not everyone's going to stay for 20 years. We know that's the key. So how do you look at it? I prefer to think about it in 2 year increments because there's a lot that you can do in 2 years and it's a measurable, kind of achievable thing to do, right? The college degrees kind of happen in 2 year chunks. You got associates, you got bachelor's, you got your master's, you got your doctorate. And I think that's a good way to kind of think about it. It's not too short. You know, I don't want to think about it in terms of weeks. I want to think about it in 2 year stints. What do you think, Rich?
So I'm going to piggyback off of Kyle here. Like this 24 month or 2 year stint planning, for deliberate planning, where you're actually going to take actions on a daily, weekly, or monthly basis to set yourself up for success, is very, very smart. And not only that, but like being in the private sector, that's generally when promotions occur, right? So most people are used to in the service PCSing, doing a permanent change in station, right? Like between 24 months and 36 months. So that's generally the promotion cycle for most private sector companies, right? If you're working somewhere and delivering against goals for a 24-month period of time, you're probably going to get promoted if you're doing really well. And if you're not, you should be asking yourself, what's going on here? I don't know if you agree with that, Kyle, but like that's how I look at things, right? So, So having that 2 year outlook, that 24-month outlook is great to have. Also because, let's be honest, right? Like private sector organizations and even public sector ones that are not, you know, the actual military service, right? They look at things in a very goal-driven way. So if you're planning something 5 years out, chances are private sector companies, they have a vision for 3 to 5 years, but they're not looking at that in a deliberate manner, right? They're looking deliberately at 24 months or less. What can I do in the next year to raise my revenue, right? And allow me to earn, you know, a profit, right? If you're on the private sector side, right? If you're on the public sector side, it's the same thing. It's like, what are my goals in the next my annual period or my 24-month period that actually make a difference and a change in certain public sector mission sets. So so the 2 years thing is great, but what I would say too, and then I'll turn it back over to you guys, is I don't think it's ever too early to start figuring out what you're passionate about. Like, what do you want to contribute to this world, right, that is uniquely Rich Vaccarello, right, or John Schreiner, or, you know, Kyle Machado? Like, what is uniquely you that you can, on the dime, give an elevator pitch about, right, to anybody who asks you? So I guess I'll leave it at that, and I'll push it back to you guys.
Yeah, Rich, I give people this advice all the time. I say, find the thing you love most in this world and do it nights and weekends for the rest of your life. And find the thing that you are the absolute best at and find someone to pay you a boatload of money to do that thing. And that is controversial advice to some people, because everyone's like, do what you love. And I'm like, I completely disagree with that statement. Like, if you want to kill a thing that you love, be forced to do it as your job 8 hours a day, every day, and have your paycheck rely upon it. It's a death knell for passion. But so, Rich, I want to agree with everything you said there, right? Like, we got to have that plan and get it in way. So can we talk about some actionable advice? Like, can we like give an example here? And I'm happy to lead off with this, but just want to say, like, let's do this, right? We're 50 minutes in. Let's give some actionable advice, and we'll use a like vanilla example somebody. What do you say?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So
use me.
Oh, let's use John. All right, John, you're atypical. I hate to say that, buddy, and I mean it in the best way, but all right, so let's do this. Let's go 2 years out, right? And let's say you want to get a job in tech, and we'll just use something really generic. And in fact, I want to use something that, Rich, you and I are tangentially related to, but never directly. So let's say that you are a big fan of Microsoft Azure, and so you want to get out and you want to do like Azure-y stuff, and you have absolutely nothing today. You just have experience of being a Marine. So let's go 2 year plan. Number one, and this again, controversial, go get a 2 year college degree and do it while you're in the military when the cost is extremely low / free with your GI Bill or whatever it is now, and then get some certifications that you think will help you. And here's the deal. You're 2 years out. Most of those certifications will likely expire by the time that you get out, but I don't care. I want you to have the book learning, because the book learning means a whole lot more in the outside world than it does in the military. Because in the military, just, can you get it done? Yes. But you have to remember that you're already there. You've already made it. You've got the Eagle, Globe, and Anchor. In the outside world, you have to get hired, and you need to understand that there is a certain vetting process, which is done by a computer every single time. Does the person have a college degree? Yes or no. Does this position require a college degree? Yes or no. And if you don't meet that criteria, your resume is out of the system. It's that fast. And there are certain certifications that operate the same way. And so if you have 2 years, I would say immediately focus on getting an associate's, and immediately focus on getting the certifications in your particular field. That's my 2 year plan. Rich, what do you think?
Yep. Let me jump in on that. So I'll amplify that with this. What does that mean to somebody else? Just so you know why Cal is throwing that out there, outside of the reasons they already gave. One, doing something for multiple years shows commitment, right? Commitment to a specific thing, not just to an organization that you're loyal to. Loyalty and commitment, subtly different, right? Can overlap, but commitment to actually accomplishing a goal is what employers are looking for, no matter where they're at. So agree with pursue the college degree, right? Whatever it is, whatever program. Show commitment to a goal set, right? Second thing, what generally educational programs give you is the ability to demonstrate you know how to work in small teams. Another huge thing employers want to see, can they work with multiple people or lead multiple people in a specific direction, right? So that's the plus double click on the college degree, right? The certificates, what I would recommend, and I think Kyle and John would agree with this, is look for certificates that generally are practitioner based. What I mean by practitioner based is that they're performance based. At the end of the training, you get a certificate that says, I can do this thing, not just I know this thing. The best certificates are the ones that are recognized for knowing and doing. And then that what that does is it gives your future employer a baseline. Here are the baseline set of skills they know how to do because they got that certificate, even if it's expired, right? To Kyle's point. So,
that's right.
So totally agree. Kyle, where are we going to go next?
Okay. So I want to do one more thing that you said there, and we're going to go a little over our hour, and I hope that's okay with everybody at home because I hope this is valuable, but I want to add something there. I simply don't care if you want to pass your security plus. And I have to say this because the question comes up from people in the Marine Corps all the time because of the, is it the 8570 or 5870? I can't remember the acronym anymore, John.
8570.1 mic.
There you go. Okay. So like there's a requirement that you get a security cert. And so everyone's like, I want to get the SEC plus. And then Marines think to themselves, I've been in for 4 years and I got my SEC plus. I'm going to get out and rock the CASBAH. Well, let me just explain a couple things here. Get the certification that is practitioner based, to Rich's point, and get it for the level you want to be. Because if you have a SEC plus and 4 years of experience in the military, you are qualified to do one job and one job only, and that is run a help desk. And that's just not a super growth market right now. It's a job, don't get me wrong, but like I want you to be extremely successful in whatever it is that you want to do. And so go one step further. So if we're looking at the 8570.1 mic to you know reference John real quick, go with the biggest thing you can. Go with the CISSP or whatever the what's like the biggest thing that's on that list, John?
CISSP is at the level 3. So that's awesome. The highest level cert.
Go with that one because CISSP makes decisions in a company. CISSP helps people understand macro level security issues, not just like how to I remember in my Security Plus there was like how do you stop a fire? It was literally a question on my Security Plus exam and I remember at that moment being like, what am I doing getting this cert? But just go big on those if you possibly can. It's not a huge thing, right? Like lots of people get their CISSP, and if you study for it and you have experience in cybersecurity, which almost every Marine in comm is going to, like you can pass that exam, I promise, and it will have a huge weight in the outside world. Anyway, okay, so there's 2 year. Let's go to 4 year plan. We're going to just use the default, get your bachelor's degree. And I'm going to throw out there, I actually don't think that you should go much higher than that unless you have a specific need to get your master's or doctorate, which there are specific needs that are out there. But in IT, a bachelor's, I believe, is all that you need. Many CTOs that I have worked for and with, that's all they have, and it's all you really need. In tech, I'm going to preface that. If you want to go get an MBA, that's a kick-ass degree that you should invest in because business makes the world go round. But I digress. And then go with a rounded out certification or, and hear me out, if you have 4 years, teach yourself to build something in code. I don't care what it is. It could be infrastructure as code on a cloud provider. It could be the game of Battleship written in Python. I don't care. Teach yourself to code something and then make it public and use it on your resume. And just because everybody loves to see that, if you've made a thing and it's out there and people can look at your code, you will get more opportunities than you would if you do not have that. So, okay, Rich, throwing it back to you.
Yeah, so picking up from that, I mean, you just just look at what four-year institutions are doing now or have done in the past 10 to 5 years. Like you look at most of, you know, I didn't go to an Ivy League school, right? There are those that do, but I'll tell you, most of them now, every school you go to, like Harvard has computer science for all of their entry-level freshmen coming into the organization. That is a class they must take. They must learn how to build code, right? Why? Because it's just part of doing business now, right? That's where business exists, right? So there's a couple different books that talk about the theory of, you know, information technology as a commodity, not a commodity, all that kind of stuff. My point here is Kyle is spot on in like, go teach yourself how to code or go to a place like Coding Dojo, right? There are amazing places that'll teach you full stack coding, right? And you'll learn how to like, do the back end, do the front end, right? Understand what middleware looks like. And you might not even remember by the time you transition out, like the details of the libraries in a language, right? But just having the vocabulary and understanding how things are built will immensely carry you forward.
Yep.
So looking at the four-year period, you definitely have time in a four-year period of time to, you know, write a script, write some code, put it on GitHub. And then it's there. So when people ask you like, hey, do you know this stuff? You're like, yeah, check this out. This is what I did, right? If you're going into that field or exactly. Fields that need that. The second thing I would say, you know, the strategy advice I kind of gave a little bit earlier about like location versus vocation. This is when you want to look at it, the 4 year mark, right? You want to start looking at emerging markets, what physical location do you want to go to, whether it's family or personal related, or these are the jobs I'm interested in, and it looks like right now these are the hotspots for where those jobs are popping up, right? Kudos if both those things line up and you're like, yes, this works for me. Yep. But the 4-year mark is really when you start want to start looking at vocation versus location, if that makes sense. So, where do we want to go next, Kyle?
Okay, so I want to caveat one thing really quick and say, if you want to get out and be a manager, so let's say that you've been in for 15 years or 20 years and you're retiring and getting out, right? You are going to want something that also signifies to the civilian sector that you understand leadership. Now, I'll also preface that by saying every single person who knows that you just got done with 20 years in the military is going to know that you're a leader, and that not just a leader, but like a leader who will wipe the floor with the rest of the leaders that they probably have in their organization. Because spoiler alert, even if you've only done 4 years in the military, you are qualified for any management position in the history of the world. Just gonna throw it out there. That's my endorsement. I will hire you any day of the week for a manager role. The second piece, though, is that in the outside world, management of resources is actually a thing that has to happen, right? So like, go get a project management certification. Even if you have no desire to be a project manager ever, understand how that world works. And I'll also say, you know, I've said it before in this podcast, like the Marine Corps planning process is the jam. Like, apply that in the outside world and you will be successful, but like, get something that proves that you understand how to manage time and resources, and something like a project management certification or a certification in Agile or Scrum. There's lots of different terms that are out there that kind of all mean the same thing. How do you make time and resources work to accomplish the mission? Get those also. Because if you're like, I'm getting out in 20 years, there's 0% chance I'm going to be hands-on keyboard writing code. Cool. Go put that into some sort of management certification or prep.
Yeah. The only small thing I'll add to that is just remember that if you want to get out and be a leader, right, to Kyle's point, you have the leadership skills if you've been in the armed forces, right? You're taught that, right? But knowing how to lead other leaders, I'm going to foot stomp this, lead other leaders. And when I say other leaders, like Kyle mentioned, project managers or program managers, right? Whether they're technical or non-technical, you have to know what motivates them in order to lead them. So understanding their vocabulary, because everybody's like, oh, I got to learn tech. Well, you also got to learn the vocabulary of the people that are going to be driving the programs for you if you want to manage a portfolio and be an executive leader, right? And let me tell you,
yep,
there's no rest for the wicked there. So if folks think like, hey, I'm going to be a manager and like, oh yeah, this is going to be great, and I'm going to have all these people that do stuff for me. Let me tell you, right, you're going to be busy. And I'll just leave it at that. So back over to you, Kyle.
Yeah. So let's keep going with that line of thinking and say, okay, so you've got more than 4 years that you're thinking out. You're somebody like John, who's got 5+ to go, right? What I would say that you need to do is start working on your EQ skills outside of the military. Because again, managing inside the military where you have the UCMJ to back you up for all your decisions is easy. I'll just leave it there. It is so much more nuanced and difficult in the outside world. And also understanding how to communicate with people in the outside world who don't, you know, curse at the same frequency that you curse, or move at a speed that you want to move at, which may be wildly faster than what they're used to doing. Like, you have to know how to soften yourself for that. You have to know how to never ignore your Marine heritage, and never ignore your Marine leadership and, you know, bias for action, all the things that make us great as Marines and as Marine veterans. But you need to also increase the tools in your toolbox for dealing with people who are not Marines. And, you know, go learn about conflict resolution and negotiation and, you know, leading. I had someone recommend a book for me about leading millennials recently, and it was a great book. So, I mean, you know, do all these things, because you are going to have the outside civilian IT world culture slap you in the face hard when you get out. And John, I'm going to kick it over to you for a sec, because you did an externship. I don't know if that's the right term for it, right? But at a civilian IT place, and how'd that go for you?
Yeah, so it was interesting, because wildly successful and also requiring a lot of self-reflection. I think it was, I wouldn't say abrasive, but like very different for them to move at the speed. But I also know there were and I mean, like, I feel like I'm one of the Marines who has quite a bit of, you know, like I went to the University of Michigan and got a social justice degree. So it's a little bit different for me, right? But even that, I still have quite a bit more of an edge than maybe you are used to in the civilian world. And I can pick a couple different relationships that, you know, I was leaned on by my leadership to be very aggressive, and I was very aggressive. And some of those rounds that were fired, there was no taking back. And some of those relationships were kind of irreparable, you know?
Yeah.
And so the thing I take away from that is you got to embrace a lot that you've learned in the military, but you also have to understand that there are some people that are not going to be able to hear what you have to say, even if it is like, I still think the words that were said were completely relevant and accurate and what should have, maybe not what should have been said, but what needed to be said, and yet not the right thing. If that makes sense.
Yeah. And you're going to screw it up, right? Like you're going to kick them into the stands pretty regularly in the beginning.
Yeah. You are going to shank a couple punts, here and there. Even when you were told to kick in a certain direction. Yeah, definitely.
Yep. So, you know, that's a big piece that I would start investing in early, right? And learn how to read and consume information early. If you're going for a job, like you want to be a data scientist or something, or you want to be a researcher, maybe an advanced degree planning for that, how are you going to end up getting your doctorate someday? Although I think that that is... I mean, bluntly, if you know that the field that you want to get into needs it, it's a lot of money and a lot of time for not a lot of payoff at the end in IT, because, you know, just a kid coming out of high school who has focused for the last 2 years on the technology piece that you need can get the job. He doesn't need anything, and he'll be very successful at it as well. And so just the barrier to entry is very low. So just know that you need to get that. You know, Rich, what do you think about, you know, past the 4 year mark, when you've got, you know more than 4 years, what else would you say is a good thing to start checking the box for?
Yeah. So the emotional intelligence stuff you talked about is spot on, right? Like knowing how to read people, inspire them, right? Participate with them so that even if you're in a leadership position, you folks feel and know that you are rolling your sleeves up and working with them, even if you disagree, right? There's nothing wrong with professionally disagreeing. Actually, most people would like prefer not to work with somebody that always agrees with what they have to say, because it's just they're looking for other expert opinions, right? So once you kind of earn trust and have this competency thing, we talked about this during the MCDP7 discussion about like, Marines trust competent leaders. The same thing works on the private sector side. Like people trust other competent people, whether you're a leader or not. You can be an individual contributor, a manager, whatever. But what I would also say, and Kyle hit about this kind of in kicking it over to me, is what you can work on outside of 4 years, right, towards the 5-6 year mark, and then inside your 4 year mark, because people ask like, hey, Rich and Kyle, like why are you guys recommending college degrees? Like, one, colleges are expensive right now. Two, everything's moving to like free open source type education. Like, here's why. You need to know how to write effectively.
Yes.
What do you get out of a 4 year degree?
Yes.
Reps and sets on writing. In different formats and with different taxonomies, right? So I can't tell you what a shock to the system it was in a good way for me when I got to Amazon and found out no longer was PowerPoint a thing. So my initial reaction was like, I'm going to do a cheetah flip and just feel amazed, right? Then they were like, hey there, budding leader, you need to write a 6-page document that talks for each one of your goals that's going to outline with data why it's important for our customers. Go, those are due next week. Have fun. See you next week. Bye. Right? So writing, communicating. Kyle's talked a lot about the EQ, emotional intelligence part of it, communicating with people. But I cannot tell you how important writing is in learning how to measure things is the second thing I would add. So there are great books on there on how to measure anything. I think that's actual titled the first book that I read when I was getting out, recommended by those folks in Marine for Life. But if you know how to write and measure, oh my gosh, that's what you need to start at the 5-year mark, because you need reps and sets on that. as you get closer in, just with like putting your professional documents out there,
yep.
right? So at the 2-year mark, when you're looking for actual jobs and being deliberate, people are going to say like, what is this person published? Right. And they want to know, like, can you gather data and make an argument and go from there? So anyhow, sorry for being super passionate there, but like, I agree on the EQ side of things, and I would add effective writing and measurement as two huge things you could do at the 5-year plus mark. Back to you guys.
Yeah. And I definitely see, like, if someone's got a 4-year degree, and you know, this is a bit crass, but like, it proves they can put up with some crap for 4 years in a diverse, weird way of them learning things that maybe aren't in their wheelhouse and be successful. And to your point, Rich, like, and they can write about it, like the ability to express what you want to express cleanly and concisely in the written form is the key to success in any organization from a leadership and influence perspective in the outside world. Because, you know, the Marines will just get into a room and figure some stuff out. Cool. That's awesome. But like, I work with people all over the planet. I simply can't get into a room with them often. And so I have to write it down and I have to send it, and it better be, you know, proper grammar, and it better have its points outlined very clearly in the first page, because I know they're not going to read past that. And like, all these things that you got to get good at. And the Marine Corps doesn't necessarily prepare you for those things, because, you know, the bias for action of the Marines, you don't have time to write about it. You're going to make the decision. You're going to talk about it for a couple minutes, and you're going to go take that hill. That's how you want it, right? I wouldn't want my leaders to have to slow down and write everything down when they're, you know, in the point of friction. But in the outside world, that's just not it. It needs to be written, and you need to be successful at it. Okay, so I know we are like wildly over on time, John, and so Rich and I want to collectively apologize for blowing past that. And let's talk about one more subject before we go, maybe?
Yeah, absolutely. So the thing, so we talked about what we should do to prepare and some of the different strategies and the timelines and all that kind of stuff. And that all kind of builds to the precipice of you sitting down for an interview for the job that you've decided based on your plan that you want. So talk to me a little bit about what that interview looks like, and give me an idea. Has my Marine Corps programming and training prepared me for this moment, and I just need to go there and be the me that they've taught me to be? Or do I need to deprogram all of that and do something completely different?
I think that most Marines should do very well in an interview for one reason, and that is, if you just go into the interview like you're talking to your CO, right? Like, and just keep that in mind. And, you know, we talked about demilitarization. I think that's the number one thing to be successful in an interview if you're coming out of the service, is demilitarize everything that you've done, translate that into normal speak. But like, speaking clearly and respectfully, and like, I don't know, those two skills alone, I think most Marines will come out with, you know, extreme examples and familiarity and comfort in doing those two things. And I can't stress how rare that is in interviews, having done many, many, many interviews. Just those two pieces are the good start. So Rich, I'm going to kick that to you for comment.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. I would add just a couple of things. So the first one is, you do have to be you, right? When you go into an interview, there's nothing worse than, Kyle can probably double click on this one, when you can tell that somebody is trying to play a role, right? So being genuine is super key, because it's going to put the interviewer at ease, right? When they're talking to you. Two, be confident, right? And be bold. And this is what I think was where he's kind of, where Kyle's talking about, like, Marines are prepared, or people in the service are generally prepared for this. But, you know, just be confident, right? Like, there's a reason you applied for that job. So if you get to the interview stage, which, by the way, is a huge milestone, because you're now sitting down talking probably to members of the team that you're seeking to join, remember, be genuine, because you could land on their team, right? So you don't want to like say something in there that later you prove false, right? And mostly those are behavioral things. But two, you also just want to remember, like, you know, this is the team you're seeking to join, right? So you want to have, you know, relevancy to their conversation. So they're going to evaluate you from two perspectives. One, from a competency perspective, like, do you have the skills they're looking for? Because that's what they need on their team. That's the gap. And then they're going to look at you from a cultural perspective and say, is this person going to fit in on my team in the larger organization writ large? So where you can do your intelligence gathering on the culture that is internally recognized at the organization, understanding what type of like culture you're getting into will help you kind of be a better fit. So when you're in these interviews, outside of just being competent and technically proficient, because you're going to get those questions, right? If you go for a software development engineering job and you don't think you're going to get asked questions on how to code, then you're just, you have poor expectations, right? But more importantly, like you want to be genuine and you want to understand what the culture is of that organization is a little bit. You don't have to know it that greatly, but just recognize, like, do a little research and understand, like, hey, is this organization like an organization that works like a startup, so they want everybody to roll up their sleeves and be super busy? Is this organization more of one that like really, really values writing over presentation skills and stuff like that? And you might never get that level of detail, but just, I would say, when you get to the interview stage, realize, one, like, relax a little bit because you've got to that point, which many people do not get to. And then, two, be genuine. And three, understand the culture of the organization you're trying to join. Oh, I'll turn it back to you, Kyle.
Yeah, I mean, interviews are tough. But they're not tough if you're just yourself. And to your point, right? I can tell in the first minute if someone's not themselves in an interview. Like, Rich, how long does it take you to like spot the person putting on a show?
Oh yeah, I think now we're at the point of that's probably less than 30 seconds because you can just tell by the body language. It's not even what they say.
That's right. Right. There's so much to it, right? And everything now is done remotely, right? But like, you know, dress nice. Don't dress like you're going to the Oscars, but dress nice, right? Like, I think that anyone showing up for an interview in a, I don't even know, a button down, a polo or whatever, like you're good to go. You don't need to necessarily wear a suit, but you know, a blazer's never a bad idea, right? Be professional when you go into that. I've known plenty of people that have gotten jobs in a hoodie and a t-shirt though, and just depends on where you're going and what you're trying to interview for. But it's never a bad idea to make a good first impression by looking good and being put together. And then just be yourself after that. And I'm going to tell you right now, most organizations, when they interview you, they're going to know if you know your shit or not, because they're not going to put idiots in the room with you. No one who isn't good at their job gets asked to do interviews. Like the organization I'm working for now, like anyone who passes our technical interview for our cloud team, they know what they're doing because our team has sussed out how much experience they actually have. And they know the questions to ask. And everyone that I have interviewing for my team right now, they've been in this industry for so long that they like, you know, they can talk about any subject in depth and know if someone is blowing smoke. And that's the thing I'll also say in your interview, folks, don't ever lie. Don't ever make it up. The words, I really don't know the answer to this one, but I'll work on trying to figure it out, mean so much to me. Anyone who's going to interview for a role on my team, if you're listening to this podcast in some sort of weird pre-research stalking, know that I'm asking you questions that I don't expect you to know the answer to, because I want to hear you say, I don't know, because that's such a valuable skill. We're in this field that changes. I feel like every 4 months, there's something revolutionary coming out. Like adaptability and the ability to go learn stuff quickly. That's what I care about. I don't need you to know much. I need you to know where to go to find much. That's such a critical element. So just also, just don't lie. Don't try to like fluff it. If you're in an interview and I like ask you a question about networking and you pull something out of your butt, I am diving into that hole because I want to see how far you dig your own grave, or I want to see if you'll actually cave and say, you know what, actually, I don't think I know this one as well as I need to, and I need to figure it out. And in which case, you've won that question. Move on. Anyway, that's my rant.
Yeah, I think the only thing I would add there, and I know we're getting close to time here, John, is to Kyle's point, what a lot of employers are looking for, a lot of hiring managers like Kyle and I Kyle's in that role, I got to be in that role for a long time. What they're looking for is the why you're making the decisions you're making, right? Even if you don't remember the exact syntax, or like, for example, if you're in a tech role, and I don't remember exactly what the commands are I need to type, but the why you're doing that is the most important part. So when you get to questions, and this would be my pro tip, where you hit your ceiling, do what Kyle said. Say, hey, I've hit my technical ceiling there. I actually don't have experience in this. However, this is how I would approach that problem. Because what that does to the interviewer is it says a couple things. One, you're willing to tackle new challenges. And two, it just doesn't make the interview awkward where you just sit there and say, I don't know, next question, right? You're just think think through it logically, right? And give yourself some time, space. So while you're saying the phrase, I've hit my technical ceiling or whatever, insert that reason, you're thinking about how you would approach the problem and then approach it that way. I would always tell folks when I was going through my interview processes, when I transitioned, hey, do you guys have a marker? And they would go look for a whiteboard marker. And as they were looking for it, I was formulating my plan. They toss it to me and then I'd go whiteboard my thoughts out, right? But that works for me because that just, I know myself, right? So anyhow, my point in saying that little rant is being genuine, being honest is super cool. Knowing when you've hit your knowledge technical gap or non-technical gap is great. And then just give people your thought process. Here's how I would approach it.
Yep. And I'll also say this, there's a lot of resources out there about technical interviews. Like if you go, for example, just research like Amazon's interviewing process, because I really respect Amazon for the way that they build their interviews and the structure that they apply there. It does make it easy to, you know, measure people's knowledge and efficacy. Like go research that out and game it, meaning like get someone to ask you questions and practice the delivery of those. Practice is a critical thing when you're trying to sell yourself. Don't just think you're going to go in and wing it. And the more prepared you are, the more confident you'll be. And like things just get better from there. So, you know, use some game theory on this a little bit. Practice the responses that you're going to give. And always remember, if you put it on your resume, it's fair game for me to ask you about. So if you that one time installed Linux, I can very easily tell if you did it or not and how much you learned and retained. So just like also be cautious around like I've seen people with networking resumes who literally list like every protocol from the appendix of the CCNA book. And I'll be like, all right, you know ARP, huh? We will cease.
Fluent in Microsoft Excel.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That one, too. Like, nobody cares if you know Office. Like, stop putting that on resumes. But, like, you know, to John's point, right? Like, John, how long would it take you to know if someone knows ARP? How many questions to find out if someone knows ARP or not?
Oh, man. Generally, if you know it, I'll know in about a question.
Yeah. One question. That's all it'll take, right? So just make sure you're putting, you know, you could just put like expert level network skills and don't list out, you know, VRRP and, you know, all these other things that I'm going to just tear you apart with. Same with, you know, cloud technology and things like that. So just keep your resume focused and to the point. Resumes should focus on getting you in the door. Last thing, I'm going to end it with this, right? Which is the resume gets you to the interview. After that, it's on your ability to sing and dance and sell yourself as a resource and the value that you're going to bring to an organization. And also, like, don't take no for an answer sometimes is a great way to show a little bit of ambition. If someone's like, hey, we're going to go with another candidate, come back human. Come back and say, hey, I'm really disappointed about that. That kind of sucks. But listen, I'm willing and able to do hard work and I want to work for your company. So if you have other positions that come up, let me know. And I'm very happy to get some feedback from you about what I could do better next time. Because that's the thing. Recruiters are people and they don't want to treat you like a commodity. They want to treat you like a person too. They want to be treated like a person. So just come at that with humility and humanity goes a long way. Like when I'm in interviews and so, you know, I always give people the last few minutes to chat in an interview and they, you know, thank us for the time. That actually means a whole hell of a lot to me when they tell us like, hey, if you got any questions, let me know, or I may follow up with you about something. And like, look, if you are in an interview and you get to one of those, actually, I don't know the answer to this question, but I'll figure it out. Figure it out. Send them an interview back and say, hey, I actually researched that question. I researched the problem and this is how I should have answered that. And give them a paragraph. Like that would go a long way with me too. So anyway, I'm gonna call it there. We're at way over an hour. Rich, any closing thoughts you want to add to that?
The only thing I can say is I've had people do that where they've come back to me like 6 months later after an interview. And guess what? I reached out to them because more positions came open.
Yeah.
It just shows perseverance and like humility and it's awesome.
Yeah. And again, who you know, right? Like, yeah, if I interview you and we hit it off, send me a LinkedIn request. I would love nothing more than that. And if you want to touch base again in a few months, again, I would love nothing more than that. We're always looking for quality talent in this world. And if you're growing professionally, maybe you're not where we need you to be yet, but you're working on it. I want to know that. I want to have the first opportunity to hire you when you're at the level we need. And just, you know, that's just me. It's really hard to hire folks. And when you find good people, you want to hire them. Sometimes you can't, but that doesn't mean, you know, you can't tomorrow or the next day.
Excellent. And yes, as both of you mentioned, we are way over time. So I'm going to break with tradition and I will start off with one of my saved rounds here, things that I didn't get a chance to get in. And I'm certain that the type of person this applies to will not be listening this long in the cast. However, I do need to say, if you are the active duty military person who has waited your entire career to get a certification and decided to do so in the twilight, i.e. you got your PMP or your CCNA or your SEC Plus in your last month of service, I'm going to look at your resume from now, like from now on the rest of my career, I'm looking at these resumes and I'm going to be looking if you got your certification in the last month. And my question is going to be, why didn't you get that when that was relevant to the job that you are doing? Why didn't you better yourself in a way that could have benefited you and the Marine Corps? Because I can tell you your SEC Plus or your CISSP or your PMP or Agile Scrum Master or whatever it's going to be could be of so much benefit to the Marine Corps. And not only that, me as a potential employer, I'd much rather you have a certification that you had a couple years to put what you learned and what you codified in knowledge to the test and got an ability to morph your personal vision of that than you doing it in the last month or week of service. Like, please, for the love of God, stop doing that. Like, get your certifications and your training while you and your Marines can benefit from it. Kyle, over to you.
Yeah, I'll close this out. My closing comments will be the following. I acknowledge I've been fairly critical of many things in this podcast this week, but I want to very, very strongly also say that I absolutely loved every single second that I spent in the Marines. And I spent almost 12 years, like 11 years and change in there. And I wouldn't change it for a thing. I wouldn't go back and get out at my four-year mark or do anything crazy like that. I got out when I needed to get out, and the Marine Corps was extremely good to me in that process. So I just want to make sure that, like, I'm not telling everybody, please get out, because that's not the case in any way, shape, or form. What I'm saying is educate yourself, have a plan for staying in for 20, because a military retirement is the jam, and giving 20 years of your, you know, hard work and dedication to your country and to your service is an admirable thing. I, you know, will always regret that I didn't make it to 20 years, but it worked out pretty well for me in the outside world, and it can for you too, whether you get out at 4 or 12 or 30. So with that, I'll close out and say I am on social media, Kyle Moschetto. If you can spell my name, you can find me. Like I said, I'm active in the military Facebook groups as well for the Marine Corps IT. If you ever need any advice, please reach out. And if anyone's out there who has a lot of cloud skill, especially in Google Cloud Platform, I am hiring like crazy right now. I can't help but plug this. Please, I want to talk to you. I really, really do. That's all I got, guys. Thanks.
Rich.
Yeah, my only thing is remember, own it, right? As you go into transition, that is the most important thing, is that you own it, you pick a strategy, and then you go all in, and reach out to those that have gone before you, and you can't go wrong. That's really all I have to add. Thanks, guys.
All right, everybody. Just a reminder, we are on Twitter at USMSki_TF Phoenix. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.
Bye, everyone.